Good morning. It's good to be here again with you. Also, bringing greetings from Walla Walla. It's been a good week to be here. I enjoyed my time here, substituting for Mr. Joel. They treated me really well, and looking forward to coming back here next week. Open your Bibles to 2 Kings for a text. 2 Kings chapter 9. I want to look at a story here and see if we can see ourselves in it. It's been said often that the Bible is a mirror that reflects back to us who we really are. That kind of cuts through who we would like to be and who we think we are and who other people think we are and shows us who we are. And so I want to see that in this story of a man who reflects ourselves back to ourselves in maybe a little bit of a graphic or a jolting way. Maybe we wouldn't see ourselves in this man unless someone pointed it out. And that's the story of this man named Jehu. And the story of Jehu is a bloody story, a grisly story. It's a story of a hard man, a man who people kind of got out of his way when they saw him coming. He was a man who had no mercy. He meted out his judgment and his punishment and his justice without any mercy. He was also a bold man. He was a fearless man. But he was an ambitious man. He was a hard man, and he was a man who drove furiously. And that kind of sums him up, what the Bible says there. And so I want to take a look at the life of Jehu and see if we can identify some disguises. That's the title of my message, Disguised as a Christian. Looking like a Christian, wearing Christian disguises. What are some of the disguises that we often use to cloak who we really are, to cloak our real intentions and motives under a Christian veneer or disguise? And there is a tendency we have to use God rather than worship God. We see that in the Bible. Different examples. Simon the sorcerer, he wanted to use God. Baal wanted to use God. Many other people that we could look at wanted to use God. And very often we're that way. We often agree, if not in word, at least in practice, with the American founding fathers when they said that we all have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. An inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we agree with that, if not in word, at least in practice often. And not only that, but we often kind of conceive of God as it's kind of His responsibility to facilitate that end, to make us happy, to make us free, to make us, and He does make us free, but in a different sense here. And so we try to use God. God becomes a beast of burden and a means to my end. He's a convenient sideshow to get me where I want to go. That is the context in which I want to look at this. But God isn't a useful God. He's not a useful God. He's a holy God. Revelation 4 says, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. And Romans 11:36 says, For Him and through Him and to Him are all things. It's not about us, it's about Him. He is the Creator, we are the creatures. And we get that confused. We get that conveniently confused sometimes. The Bible talks about those who are willingly ignorant. And that's the who is God and who is the servant is not a confusing concept, but we have somehow we've become very adept at those convenient confusions. And let's not orchestrate those confusions when we need them. I want to try to expose ourselves how we do that. We're often wearing a disguise, appearing as a Christian to achieve our ends, trying to make God a useful God. So the story of Jehu is in chapters 9 and 10 of 2 Kings. And it's a long story. And I want to read it, because I don't know how else to do it. It may take a few minutes here. But I want to read chapters 9 and 10. And I want to read them because what I'm going to say later will make a lot more sense if you are familiar with this story. It will be a lot more relevant. And often when there is a long passage read in church, we kind of think it's our time to take a little, to zone out a little bit. And when the preacher shuts up, then we'll tune back in. But if that is what's going on, then we may as well not read it to begin with, right? And so I would like to challenge you to try to follow along, or at least listen, to the extent to which you are familiar with this story when we get done. So I'm just going to read this, chapters 9 and 10. I may stop and make some comments here and there, but I'll try not to do too much. Verse 1. And Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and said unto him, Gird up thy loins, and take this box of oil in thine hand, and go to Ramoth Gilead. And when thou comest thither, look out there Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in, and make him arise from among his brethren, and carry him to an inner chamber. Then take the box of oil, and pour it on his head, and say, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door, and flee, and tarry not. So the young man, even the young man the prophet, went to Ramoth Gilead. And when he came, behold, the captains of the host were sitting. And he said, I have an errand to thee, O captain. And Jehu said, Unto which of all us? And he said, To thee, O captain. So Jehu is a ranking military leader in Joram's army here. And he went to where the headquarters were. And got his attention, said, I want to talk to you. Verse 6, And he arose and went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head, and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. And thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. Remember, Jezebel killed a lot of the prophets of the Lord. So this is God's judgment. Ahab has died, but Jezebel is still alive, and Ahab's son Joram is king at this point. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall, and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled. Then Jehu came forth to the servants of his Lord, and one said unto him, Is all well? Wherefore came this mad fellow to thee? And he said unto them, Ye know the man and his communication. And they said, It is false. Tell us now. And he said, Thus and thus spake he to me, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then they hasted, and took every man his garment, and put it under him on the top of the stairs, and blew with trumpets, saying, Jehu is king. So Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. Now Joram had kept Ramoth Gilead, and he and all Israel because of Hazael, king of Syria. But King Joram was returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which the Syrians had given him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. And Jehu said, If it be your minds, then let none go forth nor escape out of the city to go tell it in Jezreel. So Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there. And Ahaziah, king of Judah, was come down to see Joram. Now, a little bit of that background there. Joram At this point, there was the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom of Judah. And so Jehoram was king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and Ahaziah was king of the southern kingdom of Judah. And they were actually first or second cousins, I forget which, something fairly closely related. And they had gone to war together against Hazael, the king of the Syrians, recently. They had been in battle, and Joram was wounded, and he came home, and he was convalescing in Jezreel, recovering. While he was recovering, Ahaziah made a diplomatic trip from Judah and was visiting him there. So we have these two kings in Jezreel. Now here comes Jehu in verse 16. So Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, was come down to see Joram. And there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel, and he spied the company of Jehu as he came, and said, I see a company. And Joram said, Take a horseman and send to meet them, and let him say, Is it peace? So there went one on horseback to meet him, and said, Thus saith the king, Is it peace? And Jehu said, What hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, The messenger came to them, but he cometh not again. Then he sent out a second on horseback, which came to them, and said, Thus saith the king, Is it peace? And Jehu answered, What hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, He came even unto them, and cometh not again. And the driving is like the driving of Jehu the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously. And Joram said, Make ready. And his chariot was made ready. And Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot. And they went out against Jehu, and met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. And it came to pass, when Joram saw Jehu, that he said, Is it peace, Jehu? And he answered, What peace, so long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many? And Joram turned his hands and fled, and said to Ahaziah, There is treachery, O Ahaziah. And Jehu drew a bow with his full strength and smote Jehoram between his arms, and the arrow went out at his heart, and he sunk down in his chariot. Then said Jehu to Bidkar his captain, Take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden upon him. Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, saith the Lord, and I will requite thee in this plot, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him into the plat of ground according to the word of the Lord. Remember the story of Naboth and his vineyard, and Ahab coveted it and couldn't have it, and Jezebel got it for him. This was the Lord's judgment on that had been prophesied. Verse 27, But when Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled by way of the garden house, and Jehu followed after him and said, Smite him also in the chariot. And they did so at the going up of Gur, which is by Ibleam, and he fled to Megiddo and died there. And his servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in the sepulchre with his fathers in the city of David. And in the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab began Ahaziah to reign over Judah. And when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it and painted her face and tired her head and looked out at a window. And as Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, Had Zimri peace, who slew his master. And that's an interesting thing she said. She obviously knew what was going on, because if you read in, I forget exactly where it's at, either in Kings or Chronicles, Zimri did the same thing that Jehu is doing here. I believe Zimri was a military leader, and he rebelled, led a coup against the current king, killed him, assassinated him, and was planning to set himself up as king in his place. However, the people didn't like Zimri. And they said, actually, Zimri, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to make Omri king. And so they took this other man, Omri, and made him king. And I believe Zimri committed suicide, if my memory serves me right. Now, Omri was Jehoram's grandfather or great-grandfather. And so this happened several generations ago. And she sees Jehu coming, and she knows what he's planning, and she said, Had Zimri peace, who slew his master. She shouts out the window at him. Do you know what you're doing? Have you thought this through, Jehu? Verse 32, Jehu wasn't too concerned. And he lifted up his face to the window and said, Who is on my side? Who? And there looked out to him two or three eunuchs. And he said, Throw her down. So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot. And when he was come in, he did eat and drink, and said, Go now and see this cursed woman. Go see now this cursed woman, and bury her, for she is a king's daughter. And they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull, the feet, and the palms of her hands. Wherefore they came again and told him. And he said, This is the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, In the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel. And the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, This is Jezebel. Chapter 10. And Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. And Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to them that brought up Ahab's children, saying, Now as soon as this letter cometh to you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there are with you chariots and horses, a fenced city also, and armor, look even out the best and meetest of your master's sons. Set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. But they were exceedingly afraid, and said, Behold, two kings stood not before him. How then shall we stand? And he that was over the house, and he that was over the city, and the elders also, and the bringers up of the children, sent to Jehu, saying, We are thy servants, and will do all that thou shalt bid us. We will not make any king. Do thou that which is good in thine eyes. Then he wrote a letter the second time to them, saying, If ye be mine, and if ye will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men your master's sons, and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time. Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. And it came to pass, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons, and slew 70 persons, and put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. And there came a messenger, and told him, saying, They have brought the heads of the king's sons. And he said, Lay ye them in two heaps at the entering in of the gate until the morning. And it came to pass in the morning that he went out, and stood, and said to all the people, Ye be righteous. Behold, I conspired against my master, and slew him. But who slew all these? Know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of the Lord, which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab. For the Lord hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. So Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and his kinfolks, and his priests, until he left them none remaining. And he arose and departed, and came to Samaria, and he was at the shearing house in the way. Jehu met with the brethren, of Ahaziah king of Judah, and said, Who are ye? And they answered, We are the brethren of Ahaziah, and we go down to salute the children of the king and the children of the queen. And he said, Take them alive. And they took them alive, and slew them at the pit of the shearing house, even 42 men, neither left he any of them. And when he was departed thence, he lighted on Jonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And he saluted him, and said to him, Is thine heart right, as my heart is with thine heart? And Jonadab answered, It is. If it be, give me thine hand. And he gave him his hand, and he took him up into the chariot, and he said, Come with me, and see my zeal for the Lord. So they made him ride in the chariot. And when he came to Samaria, he slew all that remained unto Ahab in Samaria, till he had destroyed him, according to the saying of the Lord which he spake to Elijah. And Jehu gathered all the people together, and said unto them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu shall serve him much. Now therefore, call unto me all the prophets of Baal, and all his servants, and all his priests, and let none be wanting. For I have a great sacrifice to do to Baal. Whosoever shall be wanting, he shall not live. But Jehu did it in subtlety, to the intent that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu said, Proclaim a solemn assembly for Baal, and they proclaimed it. And Jehu sent through all Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left that came not. And they came into the house of Baal, and the house of Baal was full from one end to another. And he said unto him that was over the vestry, Bring forth vestments for all the worshippers of Baal. And they brought them forth vestments. And Jehu went, and Jonadab the son of Rechab, into the house of Baal, and said unto the worshippers of Baal, Search, and look out that there be here with you none of the servants of the Lord, but the worshippers of Baal only. And when they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings, Jehu appointed 80 men without, and said, If any of the men whom I have brought into your hands escape, he that letteth him go, his life shall be for the life of him. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of his offering, of offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the captains, Go in and slay them, let none come forth.
And they smote them with the edge of the sword, and the guard and the captains cast them out and went to the city of the house of Baal. And they brought forth the images out of the house of Baal and burned them. And they brake down the image of Baal and brake down the house of Baal and made it a draft house unto this day. Thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel. Howbeit from the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, Jehu departed not from after them, to wit the golden calves that were in Bethel and that were in Dan. And the Lord said unto Jehu, Because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hast done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in mine heart, thy children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart, for he departed not from the sins of Jeroboam which made Israel to sin. In those days the Lord began to cut Israel short, and Hazael smote them in all the coasts of Israel, from Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites, the Reubenites, and the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, even Gilead and Bashan. Now the rest of the acts of Jehu, and all that he did, and all his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jehu slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, and Jehoahaz his son reigned in his stead. And the time that Jehu reigned over Israel and Samaria was 28 years. Okay. So there is the story of Jehu, and it's an interesting story, and yet it's a common story in history, where one man kills another man, overthrows him, and sets up in his place. The story has been repeated over and over again through history, and yet it is a unique story, and the things that he did. So like I said, I want to see if we can see ourselves in Jehu. And it's in the context of using God for our purposes. Trying to make God a useful God rather than a holy God. And I have three points that are very closely related. I don't know that they are necessarily even three distinct points, but maybe perhaps three different ways of looking at the same point, or different aspects of the same point. But the first one that I see, the first disguise that I see Jehu wearing is that of Christian zeal, disguising a brutal heart. Christian zeal, disguising a brutal heart. Now the Old Testament was a brutal time. It was an uncivilized period. It was they were very barbaric. Mankind, the human race had degenerated from the flood on, and God was in the process of reintroducing himself to the human race and bringing them back to an understanding of God. But there was a work in process, and at this point the entire Middle East was basically they were basically barbarians is what they were. And particularly the Canaanites, they were extremely evil people. And the Israelites were influenced by that. They were more godly than them, but nevertheless, their reference point was that of blood and an eye for an eye and stoning a man and his whole family for stealing some garments. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of give. And so Jehu was a product of that environment. You know, anybody who orders a queen tossed out of a window, tramples her under his horse's hooves, and then goes and has dinner is a pretty hard man. And that's the way life was. But nevertheless, he had it. He called it Christian zeal. He called it zeal for the Lord. We don't like to be perceived as brutal people, at least not most of us do. We like to call it other things. We like to soften the language. We like to use euphemisms. And Jehu wasn't all that different. In verse 15 and 16 of chapter 10, he met Jonadab, and he said to Jonadab, verse 16, and he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." So Jehu wanted to make sure that everybody understood that what he was doing was because of his zeal for the Lord. And he made a point of telling Jonadab that. And I think something inside him was a little insecure. Something was a little bit defensive there. He wanted to make sure that everybody understood that what he was doing was justified. And he made that known. Now, like I said, the Old Testament was a brutal era. But God has called us to something different. He called us to emulate the life of a man who would not quench a smoking flax or break a bruised reed. So we've come a long way from that era and what God expects of us. And Jesus taught us to turn the other cheek. He taught us to love our enemies and pray for them. And I understand that Jesus also cleared the temple, but Jesus didn't teach us to clear temples. Okay, and there's a big difference between Jesus clearing the temple and Jesus telling us to clear temples. What Jesus told us to do was to love our enemies. So that's what he expects us to do. So when we are working with people, when we're working with relationships, let's not confuse Christian zeal with human brutality and impatience. Let's not engage in that self-deception, indulge our tempers, indulge our impatient nature under a fallacious banner of Christian zeal. Like Jehu did. Let's call it the old man, because that's what it is. Matthew 5:22 says, "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Rakish, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire." Whosoever is angry with his brother, and the King James Bible says without a cause, but that is the only translation that has that loophole in it. All the other translations you will read simply say, whosoever is angry with his brother will be in danger of the judgment and the council and hellfire. And so I wouldn't plan on using that loophole come judgment day, because it may not stand whether or not you had a cause, whether or not he actually did mistreat you. And so I can be angry and impatient with him. I wouldn't lean on that loophole too much. I think the teaching of Jesus is very plain. You know, we can deal forcefully with sin. We can deal thoroughly with sin and wrong ideas, and we ought to have zeal. I'm not saying Christian zeal doesn't exist. I'm saying that Christian zeal is often used to disguise an impatient and brutal heart. And I think this verse makes it plain. A good excuse to act like a jerk is not the same thing as justification for acting like a jerk. It's two entirely different things. We're called to treat people with love, regardless of how you have been treated. And whether or not you have a cause is just missing the point. It's not even part of the discussion. Whether or not you have a cause. But you know, brutality is far more than a physical act, and we Anabaptist people are non-resistant, right? We don't fight. We would never toss someone out a window and drive over them. That's not what we do. We're non-resistant. We're a little squeamish about that. You know, there's a big word used to describe the act of throwing someone out a window. I don't know why someone decided it needed a name, but they gave it one. It's called the act of defenestration. Defenestration is the act of throwing someone out a window. And so they've dedicated a word to that. And we're a little squeamish about the defenestration of Jezebel. You know, the blood splattered on the walls and the blood splattered on the horses, and Jehu rode right over top of her and he went in and had dinner. And we're a little squeamish about that. But I wonder if we're as squeamish as we would like to think. I think we've shown ourselves very often to be pretty hard-boiled veterans when it comes to verbal defenestrations over our own Sunday dinners. And you know, we don't assassinate people, but we're pretty callous to character assassinations, and we're pretty callous to tearing people down. We may not shoot a king out of his own chariot with a bow and arrow. But we're not nearly as squeamish when it comes to character assassinations. You know, brutality exists apart from blood and gore. Brutality involves words and glances and body language and communication. James says, "The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire of hell." The tongue is a fire. Now we're talking about warfare and brutal people. And I don't know if you know anything about napalm or not. But napalm is a fuel used in a flamethrower, and they can squirt that stuff up to a couple hundred feet. And it's a sticky, gelled, gasoline-type product. And if it lands on your skin, you can't get it off. And it's very flammable. And they use these weapons, and they squirt that stuff into concrete bunkers, and it hits the wall, and it splatters everywhere on all the people and ignites. And you can't get it out, and you can't brush it off. And it's a horrible way to die. And the United States military used it extensively. It still does, as far as I know. But the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. And that those words go out of your mouth like a jet of napalm. And James here says, it's the whole world's worth of iniquity. And I happen to know the world that James was talking about, and there's a lot of iniquity in it. And the tongue represents that whole world full of iniquity. And so let's not tell ourselves that because we don't shed blood, we're not brutal people sometimes. We're not hard. And we do call it Christian zeal, don't we? We do it in the context of church fights and in the context of standing up for what's right. But it's a brutal heart disguised as Christian zeal. We are taught to hate the sin and love the sinner. Hate the sin, but love the sinner. Jehu got that turned around. He hated the sinner, but he loved the sin. We read there in the end of chapter 10 that he got rid of Baal, but he didn't get rid of idolatry. He continued not the same idolatry, but he continued in idolatry. He hated the sinner, but he loved the sin. Let's not fall into that same trap of getting that principle turned around. Let's love the sinner and hate the sin. Not hate the sinner and love the sin ourselves. Okay, my second point here. Again, like I said, it's not all that different, but it's a slightly different angle. That of service to self disguised as service to the Lord. Service to self disguised as service to the Lord. And that is the second disguise that I see Jehu wearing. A man committed to serving the Lord. He said that many times in this passage, or it's referred to many times, that he did the work of the Lord, that the Lord had commanded him, as the Lord had said and prophesied. And Jehu was a man that slipped into that role, and he was serving the Lord. Except that he wasn't. Jehu was a man intent on power. He was a man intent on securing his own future as king of Israel. And if the shortest route to that end was playing ball with God, then he'd play ball with God. But he wasn't interested in the worship of the one true God. He was interested in the kingdom of Jehu much more than he was interested in the kingdom of God. But he was wearing that disguise. 2 Kings 9, here in the chapter, verse 32, says, "He lifted up his face to the window and said, 'Who is on my side?'" That was his first question. Then again in chapter 10, he says, "And he wrote a letter to the city elders saying, 'If ye be mine, and if ye will hearken unto my voice.'" And so it comes out pretty clear there what his priorities were. And I don't want to read more into those little glimpses of conversation than what we ought to. It's easy to do sometimes. The Bible is surprisingly malleable. We can kind of form it around the point we want to make and make it say pretty much anything we like often. And I want to be faithful to, you know, what were they trying to say here? And so I don't want to make more of a point of that to draw more meaning out of those verses than what is justified. But nevertheless, I think it does reflect Jehu's personal ambition that he was operating off of. And we can contrast Jehu's attitude with that of Moses in Exodus 32. And he came down from Mount Moriah, and the people had made a golden calf. And Moses stood in the gate, and he said, "Who is on the Lord's side?" He said, "Who is on the Lord's side?" And he called the Levites together, and he said, "Take your sword and wade into this crowd of people and start killing them." And it was a very bloody affair in Exodus as well. But Moses' question was, "Who is on the Lord's side?" And Jehu's question is, "Who is on my side?" Jehu saw this conflict, this judgment, as an opportunity to launch a career. God's judgment and call to action was an opportunity to launch a career. You know, we love to succeed. Everybody wants to be a success. Nobody wants to fail. We have a deep-rooted instinct to climb the ladder, to get ahead. We're competitive by nature. And we want to be the hero. We want to have a good reputation. We want to be respected. We want to be looked up to. It's hard to maintain a good reputation when you have a big mouth and a hard head, though. And like I tell my friends, it's not until you lose your reputation that you discover what a burden it was. And so that's a little bit from my perspective. But, you know, I want a good reputation. I'd like a good reputation. And we're all that way. We're all wired that way, and we may as well admit it. And a lot of us sat over there in the gym yesterday, and we listened to that presentation and watched that presentation and heard all about the beautiful things that are being done, the important, beautiful things that are being done by Cam and the people working there for the glory of Christ. And I have tremendous respect for that. But I think it would only be the liars among us that would deny the reality of the temptation to use an opportunity like that to advance my own career and my own reputation. And I'm not in the least suggesting that any of the men here are guilty of that. I'm simply pointing out, because I know my heart, if I am in a position to do something, it's a constant battle to do it for the glory of God versus the glory of me. Getting up to preach is that way. It's that way every time. It's just a constant battle. It's a constant thing. Am I going to get up here and try to impress people, or am I going to get up here and try to say what I think is true? And so it's a constant battle. We are adept at using the work of the Lord to advance our own career and image. We're very good at that. It's almost instinctual. We all want to be the hero and to be on the pictures and the newsletters and the brochures. But can we serve our own community without any recognition for years and years and years? There's people that do that, and I have tremendous respect for those people that nobody knows about. Nobody knows them. But they have had a huge impact on the people in their church. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Jeremiah says that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And I don't know of very many things that illustrate that truth better than our penchant for turning the profound responsibility of Christian service into a cheap personal campaign and self-promotion. And we do that. So, that was the second one. The disguise of self-service disguised as service to the Lord. The third one is that of a usurper disguised as a reformer. And there again, this is very closely related to what we just talked about. Maybe just a slight different angle. Maybe the ambition is personal service is related a little more to my personal success. A usurping attitude would maybe be the emphasis of being in control. somebody who wants to be in control. He wants the reins. And so he is disguised as a reformer when he is really only a usurper. Jehu willingly exterminated a wicked man's house and legacy from the land of Israel. And he willingly exterminated the Baal worshippers and the priests. And he seemed to be doing a lot of good things. He seemed to be, perhaps, introducing a revival. He was willing to yield the sword of the Lord. But very quickly, his true heart is exposed. And I referred to that a little bit. He left the golden calves in Bethel and in Dan and continued engaging in idolatry. And so very quickly it became apparent that he wasn't a true reformer. He wasn't a true reformer at all. He did destroy Ahab's family and he did destroy Baal. But he did it because their destruction dovetailed neatly with his ambition to be in control of the land of Israel and to take the throne. Now we can do a lot of good things for a lot of different reasons. And love for our brother and love for the Lord doesn't have to be one of them. We can do a lot of good things without love for God and love of our brothers. You know, we've often heard it said, there's no right way to do a wrong thing. But there is an entire host of wrong ways to do a right thing. And Jehu found one of them here. There are a lot of wrong ways to do a right thing. Reform. Pushing for reform. We need to reform things. And in that context, thinking about the Mennonite church, it's easy for us to talk about our churches. We need a lot of reforms, don't we? Just start talking to people and you'll probably be talking about something that needs reformed in the Mennonite church. You show me a Mennonite tradition or practice and I'll show you a reformer not far behind. It's just the way we operate, it seems like. And a lot of that is good. You know, we need to stay on top of things. We need to be doing maintenance. I'll just leave it at that. And we do need revival. I do think each generation needs to define itself in the context of its own world, not in the context of their grandparents' world. And we don't need to, the criticism is given sometimes, every generation, all these young people coming along, you know, we heard about that a little bit in Sunday school. And that's me, the young person coming along. They all think they need to reinvent the wheel. And I would say, no, we don't need to reinvent the wheel every generation. But sometimes the tires wear out and we need to replace the tires or at least air them up. And so some of that is legitimate. Some of that is good. But the business of reformation is inherently a dangerous business. There is a strong gravitational pull downward or worldward. And anytime we move from one position of stability and one settled position and move to another settled position, the gravitational pull is to lose ground. I don't know if you've ever hiked in the mountains and tried side hilling, walking on the side of a hill and trying to maintain your altitude. You have to aim slightly up in order to keep your altitude because you just naturally start losing altitude. And so my point is, if you're reforming things, you need to be sure that you're reforming things and not just changing things. And that's not a new thought, but I think that's something that Jehu didn't realize or he probably didn't care about it. But there's a big difference between reforming and rebelling. Okay, there's a big difference between reforming and rebelling. And Jehu didn't keep that clarity in view. He was so focused on who he was destroying and who
who was in his way on his path to the throne, that he didn't pay much attention to what he was going to build in its place once he got there. With the end result that what he got wasn't a whole lot better than what he had destroyed. In fact, it was probably worse. But at least it was his idolatry, right? At least it's his idolatry and not Jehu, or not Ahab's and Joram's idolatry, right? And that's how we act sometimes. Well, at least it'll be my idolatry and not their idolatry. But let's, if we're going to reform things, let's get rid of the idolatry. Let's not just introduce my own idolatry. And so that's the difference between rebelling and reforming. The rebel institutes his own idolatry and his own ideas. A true reformation just gets rid of the idolatry. And we can get caught up in the spirit of reformation for no other reason than that we don't like the current state of affairs. I feel like I'm kind of repeating myself here, so I'm going to just move on. But let's keep that clarity. If we're going to reform something, let's reform it. Let's not just be rebels. Let's have a conviction for the way the church ought to operate, not just a conviction that we want to be in charge and that we want to do it different and we want to do it our way. So the disguise, a usurper, somebody who wanted to be in control and in charge, disguised as a person who is reforming the kingdom of Israel for the Lord. Well, I'm going to summarize this here. It's time to close. There's an interesting epilogue to the story of Jehu, and that is found in Hosea. And it's just one verse. And it says in Hosea 1, verse 4, "And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel." Remember, that was a city where he killed Jezebel. "Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel." Because of the bloodshed in Jezreel, I'm going to avenge that on the house of Jehu. And that vengeance on the house of Jehu is going to entail the permanent destruction of the entire country of Israel. And that is what happened. That is why I said what Jehu did may have been even worse than what Ahab did. The judgment on Ahab was to destroy his family. The judgment on Jehu wiped out the entire nation of Israel permanently. If you remember, these kingdoms were divided. The southern kingdom of Judah was separate from the northern kingdom. And the Lord gave Jehu four generations on the throne because he did obey him in wiping out Ahab. And the Lord said, "I'll give you four generations on the throne." And about 20 odd years after the fourth generation of Jehu died off, the Syrians overthrew the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, and took them captive. And they never were restored to their country. Eventually there were the Samaritans that lived there, they interbred with the heathens there, and they never did recover. The southern kingdom lasted a couple hundred years, and then King Nebuchadnezzar came, the Babylonians, and destroyed them and took them captive as well. But there was a remnant. And there was a remnant that returned. That was a story of Nehemiah and Ezra. And they rebuilt the kingdom, or they rebuilt the temple. And you know the story there. But the northern kingdom never did recover. And the prophet Hosea tells us that it was directly linked to the violence of this man Jehu. The entire nation of Israel was completely and permanently wiped out. And it wasn't just because of Jehu. I'm sure there were many factors involved. But for some reason, the Lord saw fit to tell us through the prophet Hosea that this is closely linked to what Jehu did and the bloodshed and the violence that he engaged in there. Jehu carried out the will of God, but he mixed in his own resentments and ambitions with the judgment of God. Okay, he carried out the will of God, but he mixed in his own ambitions and resentments with the judgment of God. All right, so those are the three disguises: a brutal heart,
disguised as Christian zeal, service to self, disguised as service to the Lord, a usurper, and a rebel disguised as a reformer. 1 Timothy 1:5 says, "Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart, and of a good conscience, and of faith unfeigned," genuine faith. The Lord add his blessing. I'll turn the time back over to Steve.